If you enjoyed this program, please sign up for our podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com.
We tend to harvest at least 2 weeks in advance compared to like 20 years ago, for example.
To farm 128 acres of wine grapes here, we need about 30 people. It's a labor-intensive industry.
No doubt about it. The easy part in the wine business is actually making the wines, however selling it and branding it. That's a completely different story.
We've done more single vineyard calves, and it's really been the vineyard telling us where to go more than us saying, oh, we want to do single vineyard calves.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 421. This week we feature Michael Accurso, winemaker at Post & Beam Wine in Napa Valley. As I've often said, wine is like family. In some cases, wine itself becomes a family. Many wineries have a flagship or a main label, and then other brands that follow. Michael Accurso is winemaker at Post & Beam in Napa Valley, part of the Farniente and Nickel & Nickel family. We caught up with Michael last week to learn about this newest member of their Napa Valley wine family. You do want to be sure to stay in touch with these kind of relatives, since they have very good taste. You can hear Michael on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term first date wine. Today we're on the phone with Michael Accurso of Post & Beam Winery, and they're located in Napa Valley, part of the Farniente & Nickel family. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. The sun is out. In this part of the country, we don't get that this time of year very often.
Yeah, well, take it when you can get it, I guess, right?
Yeah.
We're all too familiar with it, so I take rain and clouds as much as I can here, too.
Yeah, I guess you do tend to get a tad more sun, though, don't you?
We do. We're all used to it.
Yeah, I get that. Well, thanks for taking the time to be on the show. So Post & Beam is basically a new wine, is that correct?
That is correct. It's the new addition to the Farniente portfolio, and just put the first wine in bottle this past summer, and that was a 2018 vintage, and selling like hotcakes, so really excited to see where this is going to go.
That's very good. And obviously, Nickel & Nickel and Farniente, well-known for premium, wonderful, wonderful wines. So why did you need to do another label, I'm curious?
Well, I think part of it was that there is a certain level of prestige that comes with Nickel & Nickel and Farniente. Those have been established and for quite some time, very well known in the winemaking community, culinary community, and just kind of broad spectrum of everything. We have a big group of super fans, and it's kind of been the mantra of Farniente to start something about once every decade. 1979 was the first release of a Farniente wine. It was Cabernet. 10 years later, the Dolce brand was launched, and that was focusing on late harvest dessert wines, mostly Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc. Following that was Nickel & Nickel, focusing on single vineyard varietals, mostly Cabernet and a little bit of Chardonnay, all throughout the Napa Valley. And then in 2007 was En Route Winery. That was focused on Russian River Pinot Noir. Then we move into Bella Union, which was in the mid-2012, I believe, was the first vintage of that, and that was focused on a Napa blend in general. Now, with Post & Beam, we're kind of being creative and realizing that there's, you know, a new generation, myself included in this, of wine drinkers and wine consumers. Not to say that wine collectors, high-end wine consumers aren't what is kind of the pinnacle of what we're doing in the wine business. But myself included, like I said before, we're not drinking $200 bottles of Cabernet every night. I would love it if I could, but one can't afford it. And it's fun and exciting to try new varietals. So what Post & Beam is really all about is handcrafting these wines, both Chardonnay and Cabernet from the Napa Valley, to create something that's varietal specific, kind of paying homage to classic wines While being something that's available and affordable for something that can be consumed on a daily basis.
Nice. Now, for our listeners, many who are familiar with Napa Valley, Nickel & Nickel is right on Highway 29 and is, in fact, a horse farm.
Yeah, and that's what it was, you know, prior to it becoming the winery that it is today. Beautiful piece of property right there, frontage on 29, like you said. And we still have horses out front. We want to, you know, pay respect to what was before. And they are about the happiest, most well-fed horses in all of the Napa Valley. They lived a good life for sure. Everything that we have done, we have tried to keep the historical value of what was there before.
Sure.
Farniente was a winery back in the 1800s. Then, of course, with Prohibition, things started to get shut down. But we wanted to embellish that and kind of build off of that, but still keep tradition alive to what was there and what we want to strive for going forward.
Sure. And Farniente is a beautiful winery, definitely off the beaten path there. What was the name of it originally? Do you know?
I actually do not know what it was named back in the 1800s. But yeah, as of today, you know, it's a very whimsical property. It's funny, you can see it from Highway 29. And then you take a little bit of a winding road on Acacia Drive off of Oakville Grade, and you go down a really, really long stretch of ginkgo trees that just, you know, bloom every spring and then turn this gorgeous kind of goldenrod color and a vibrant yellow during the fall, right about when we're done with harvest. So it's kind of a nice sigh of relief when you're either coming to the winery or leaving the property every day to see all the beautiful trees blooming. And then you enter these whimsical gardens as you approach the winery itself, and you almost think you're in some sort of fairy tale land, but just absolutely stunning.
Yeah, it's a very unique space. Post and Beam, I made the reference to the horses. Is that part of the idea of the name, kind of a rustic, older feel, and where did the name come from?
So that name is actually in tribute to the architectural design of Nickel & Nickel. The fermentation barns that are there are built in a post and beam style framework, and we figured keep it in the family, right? So post and beam was an easy choice.
Yes, that it makes sense really for that part of the country. So Michael, let's talk a little bit about you, your history as a winemaker back to the beginning. Were you one of those people that had that, you know, aha moment, or what led you down the path of wine?
I was 100%. I had that aha moment. I lived vicariously through a lot of winemakers and people who lived in the winemaking community growing up. I was one of the fortunate people to be born and raised in Napa. So it was always a part of my life, even though my parents had nothing to do with it. I mean, we would run through the vineyards as kids. In high school, we would do, you know, all the bad things you're not supposed to do in vineyards. You know, it's a good place to escape and hide. Let's just leave it at that. And then, you know, I didn't think I was going to have anything to do with the wine business until I went to college. And I went to a university called Cal Poly down in San Luis Obispo on the Central Coast and started studying agriculture and took a viticulture class my second year and just knew that was it. I was like, this is amazing. I had an incredibly influential professor, salt of the earth kind of guy, started teaching me how to grow vines. And really, the rest of it launched from there. So after graduating college, I went and worked at BV for a harvest, right in the heart of Napa, of course, and got a really good of exposure from all different facets of what was going on there. Worked a harvest at Silver Oak. I worked a harvest abroad down in Argentina, which is great to brush up on some Spanish. That's very, very crucial to know and learn in our industry is, you know, we work with and rely so heavily on the Hispanic community with what we do. And it's great. It's great to be able to really kind of mesh the two cultures. So it was good to get that firsthand experience working in a Latin country. Let's see. Then I came back, worked a little bit more on the Central Coast, started growing some grapes down there. And then my aha moment when I was 21, actually, a little bit before, but let's not split hairs. There's this amazing program in Napa called the Napa Neighbor. So if you could prove residency, you could taste for free back in the day. And that's dating myself at
wow,
this point.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it was a great way to take dates out and, like, you know, kind of look like a boss, but still not have to really break the bank account, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So early 20s, spent a lot of my time doing that. And I went to Duckhorn and was tasting through some of the wines. sitting on the back porch, and then I had this aha moment of a glass of Goldeneye was poured for me, and the world of Pinot Noir and how amazing the grape was and how it tasted was presented to me. And at that moment, I knew I had to get up into the Anderson Valley, work with the fruit, work with the vineyards, make some wines from up there, and ideally for Goldeneye, just because that was the wine that changed my life. And so, you know, worked a couple more harvests, did this and that, and eventually ended up there. And I worked my way from an intern to a winemaker in 5 years, and just had a blast. The Anderson Valley is a very unique, remote part of Northern California.
Yes, it is.
Located really close to the Pacific Ocean. Really, it's about 2.5 hours away from San Francisco, 2 hours away from Napa. So really kind of segregated from everything else. But one of the best Pinot Noir growing regions in on the West Coast. So got a great experience there, had a blast, like I said, and learned a ton about growing grapes, learned a ton about making wine. And it was a little bit removed, like I said, so it gave an opportunity to focus on those things and kind of put the blinders on to what else was going on in the world. And then my wife and I wanted to start a family. Due to the next steps, we decided probably time to move back to Napa. And a good colleague, friend of mine, Andrew DeLoss, who is now the director of winemaking for all of Farniente, ran into him at South Beach, Miami. There's a Best of Best food and wine festival there for Wine Spectator. We happened to be pouring wines next to each other, and I looked at him and I said, "Andrew, I'm moving back home." And he goes, "That's great." He's like, "Because I need a new winemaker to backfill my position." And I said,
"Wow."
Well, that's about as easy as an interview goes. But you know, next thing you know, I land here, and he knew what I was all about, what I was made of, and I really respected him and appreciated what he had done for the winemaking community as well. So it was a great fit, and that was in 2018. And 3 years later, here we are, and just onward and upward.
That's a great story. Just curious, do you remember the vintage of that Goldeneye?
It was the 2006 vintage. Never forget it.
There you go. I knew you would know that. I was just kind of curious. What is your output of Possum Beam? Is it meant to be a limited release, or about how many cases are you doing?
I don't know if I would say limited release. It's just kind of, you know, what we can source and what we can provide on the given vintage. We're looking at about 10,000 cases of Cabernet and 5,000 cases of Chardonnay.
Will you be doing much like Nickel & Nickel? Would there be vineyard designates or no?
I don't think we're going to stick to any specific vineyards, at least for the time being. Again, what we're trying to do is kind of show what Napa Valley can provide on a Cabernet front and on a Chardonnay front. So encompassing all of that would be a little bit difficult to do with single vineyard bottlings and designations. So, but you never know. Things could change, and it could be what the public outcry is, and we can figure that one out if we cross that bridge. But as of now, it's just going to be Napa Cab and Napa Chard.
Sure. Good. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm a big Cab guy myself. One thing I want to talk about specific to Napa, and I've been coming out there for many, many years now, getting listeners to know that Napa Valley is still there. You guys experienced incredibly horrific fires, and of course, COVID is limiting everybody, but tourism still exists and will exist in the very near future.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're not going anywhere. No one plans on it. Again, you know, it was actually funny that you bring that up, because I had an intern this year, and she asked me the same question. She goes, "Are you going to leave? Like, are you going to go somewhere else? Are you going to do something else?" Because we were in the midst of fires and in the pandemic, and you know, it was a low point in everything that was going on, right?
Sure.
And I just looked at her, and without skipping a beat, I said, "No." I said, "This is my home. This is what I do. This is what my family is built around. This is what all my friends are built around." And I said, "I'm going to stay here till the end, even if it's bitter or if it's sweet. And this is what we take pride in, and this is our life. And we're farmers, and we're winemakers, and we're community people. And whatever we have to do to make sure that this ship is on the right track is what we're going to do. You know, this isn't time to to abort mission and leave. You know, we'll rebuild if we need to rebuild, or we'll prevail if we need to prevail. And the wine industry has shown that. I mean, I had another conversation not too long ago too with someone else talking about how absolutely amazing it's been to see the creative nature of our sales teams and avenues to get exposure to people who are from all stretches of the country, world. We can do tastings with Zoom calls now that we can reach people and talk to people in every state of the country if we want to at the click of a button. And we weren't doing things like that before. And I get to see people and interact with people that, you know, as much as I love people to come out and visit and taste, and I highly encourage them to do that when everything gets lifted. But for the time being, I've been able to have so much more outreach and accessibility to tons of people who might not have ever gotten the opportunity to come out and visit as well. So it's been a really interesting kind of endeavor to see what's happened in the past 6 months, past year, and it's really kind of given us a big shot of energy into what we're doing this for in the first place and really where this can go.
That's a great attitude. Definitely strong spirit in Napa. My hat's off to you surviving that as well as having that attitude. Do you think once things do turn back to whatever normal might be that you would still continue doing online tastings?
I think so. I think that we've seen the success of it, that I would have to say that it'd be hard to say no. I don't think it'll be the frequency that we're doing it now, but I would be shocked if it isn't a part of, you know, our business model going forward.
Sure.
And I think it's smart to do so. I think, like, for the reasons I described earlier, it's just to be able to see people and experience things and all over the place to be able to do it. I mean, people love coming to Napa, and I love driving up the trail or Highway 29 to go to work every day. But, you know, I'm not gonna complain about having a couple bottles of wine sent to my house, and I can wear my pajama bottoms and a button-up T-shirt up top, and still look like I'm hosting a very eloquent, you know, dinner with a whole bunch of people, and then drink some wine with people all over the country. Right? It's great.
Yeah. As long as you don't have to get up and walk away from the camera, then that's totally cool.
Yeah, I've done that on accident a couple times. I've been called out for sure.
Oh, that's great. That would be a perfect moment. Well, this is kind of a loaded question there, you know, for your time being a winemaker. What's the weirdest thing you've seen, whether it be in the cellar or whether it be out in the vineyard?
Oh, the weirdest thing I've seen. Man, I've seen some things.
Or crazy experience.
Yeah, crazy experience. I think one of the funniest experiences I was having is growing some grapes up in the Anderson Valley, and I was working for a vineyard manager at the time, and we had done this technique called spading. And it, basically what it is an implement that's pulled behind a tractor, and it has a set of what would look like kind of shovel blades on it. So it's something used to replace a tiller, right? So tiller causes compaction, which over time is not good for soil, but a spader continuously digs into it, which basically just overturns it and gets more nitrogen in the soil, and it's really good for the soil. So we told this winemaker that we were going to spade his vineyard, and he'd never done it before, and he was really curious. And so we go out in the vineyard. It's myself. I was vineyard manager at the time. We had the foreman who was in charge of all the crews, and the tractor driver who just did the spading. And so we walked down one row. This winemaker, I won't name names, he's incredibly particular, brilliant, brilliant man, and he's dead silent, and I'm terrified, right? Like, this guy, he picks out everything, he notices everything, he is not one to shy upon giving compliments were few and far between, and it was usually, as he put it, constructive criticism. It usually ended with me in tears at the end of the day, but that's another story. But so we're walking down one of the rows, and he's just silent. And I was just like, oh, what's going to come? I was like, he's this quiet. He's taking it all in, and he's furious, and he's pissed. And what's he going to say, right? So we go down a row. He said, all right, let's walk up another one. And We start walking up the other row, and we get about halfway up it, and he drops to his knees. And I look at the foreman, and the foreman looks at me, and we both kind of have this, like, oh, shit, look on our faces, like, here it comes, right? And he digs both of his hands into the dirt, and he brings it up above him, two fistfuls of dirt, and he starts raining it on him. And he says, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. He said, this is amazing. We need to do this in every single vineyard I get wine, grapes from.
Wow.
And this guy looks at me, and the foreman, he kind of shrugs, and I wipe my brow, and I said, all right, and we're going to spade every single one of your vineyards. But it's an eclectic group of people that we work with in the wine industry, and there's not a shortage of stories like that or funny moments, that's for sure.
That's a great story, and that's why I do what I do, to hear these stories. I think, you know, people who drink wine, to get to know you guys, you know, winemakers are kind of nuts, but a lot of fun.
Yeah. We got a couple of screws loose, but it kind of comes with the territory, and it keeps things interesting.
Oh, yeah, definitely. No question about that. You know, which also brings me to a question I've asked a lot of people, and gee, do you ever have time for a hobby, or is there no such thing as a winemaker?
That's a very good question, and it's very dependent on what's going on in our world. Harvest, there is not a second for hardly anything. I'm the first one in the winery, and I try and be the last one to leave. I have a 10-month-old at home, so this...
Oh, congratulations.
This harvest, between the fires and everything going on, I tried to spend as much, you know, the afternoons as I could with him and mama at home, which the silver lining with, you know, COVID and the fires is everything was so crazy that I got to do more of that than I was expected. But typically harvest, I mean, they call them harvest widows for a reason, or widowers, because we're here all day, all night. We don't get to see, you know, our loved ones, but that's a specific amount of time. Bottlings and kind of blending, tastings, those kinds of things, same thing. You know, we're living at the winery. But when it's not those, I like to try and take the approach to really focus and reset on what's going on and what's important with you. So clearly right now I'm spending a lot of time with my family, which has just been amazing. And the other two things that I absolutely love doing in this world, and they happen to be in winter, which is right now, and this is our pseudo or quote-unquote slow season, is avid duck hunter, big-time mushroom forager. So
Oh, nice. This
is the best time to do both of those things. And if I find a couple hours in a day, I'm doing it. And that's what's going to happen. So I again, on my my admission to signing on to working for Farniente, you can only hunt ducks if it's public land on Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesdays. I told my boss, Andrew, if the wind's coming in and it's a stormy day on a Wednesday, I'll call you at 12 and I'll be in at work then. But until then, I'm out in the marsh shooting ducks.
Wow, cool. I find it ironic that you do that, having worked for Duckhorn.
The funniest thing, they always used to make fun of me because I was the only person out of the whole team over there who was a duck hunter.
That doesn't surprise me. Yeah, it's a great irony. That's so interesting. Some time ago, I was talking to a winemaker in the Finger Lakes, and I've used this a lot, and I love it. She said, you don't often meet a former winemaker.
You don't often? Well, yeah. I mean, I've never heard that. Sorry, I was in a little bit of awe and soaking it in. Yeah, that's true. You meet a lot of people who have, in, you know, kind of developed or grown into the profession, you know, have had a certain previous life, if you will, in a different facet of a different industry. But no one leaves. You're doing this for a reason. It's a lifestyle. It's a passion. It's a fully encompassing way of life. And you dive right in and you don't get out of that pool. You're here. You're a lifer for sure.
Yeah, true. That's a good answer. I don't know if you have opportunities to do much media or be interviewed, but I'm sure you have plenty of consumers asking you questions. And my question to you is, what is the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
That is a good question. As you know, being in the media, you guys are inquisitive. You ask a lot of questions a lot of times. A lot of things are usually covered. I got one for you. What's the go-to harvest breakfast? And that's super important. And it's either a breakfast burrito or a stack of pancakes to get you through the day.
That's a good one. Interesting. I never really thought about that.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're working so hard and, you know, you're working tirelessly, kind of crazy hours and everything. And we got into this industry for a few reasons, and food's a big part of it, right?
Sure.
So you got to get some good fuel in you to start the day off right. And I'm a big proponent, and my assistant winemaker and I, we're always cooking for the crew because, you know, we want to keep them going, and it's good to have those family meals. But, man, a stack of pancakes or a good breakfast burrito just really starts you on the right foot during harvest.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because you got to have something going. Plus, if you end up having to drink later on, somebody forces you to drink some wine, you got to have something in you.
You got to have a base.
That's right.
And it starts there.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would say that actually turns you off about wine? And that's pretty broad.
Yeah, that's pretty broad, but there's several things. I mean, I think that there's a certain level of pretense that comes with it. And I don't think of myself as one of those people. And I don't think that it's something that should be carried with the industry. There's things to be proud about, and there's things that should be admired. But I don't think that there should ever be a pretense or anyone holds themselves higher than anyone else just because they think they're doing something better. I mean, the whole reason why we make wine is because there's so many ways to do it, and there's so many ways to enjoy doing it, and to have people enjoy the bottle of wine at the end of what you're doing. So to have someone stand up and say, you know, this is the best wine, those people aren't doing it right, those people aren't, you know, that drives me crazy. And, you know, there's a reason we're not all making Coca-Cola, right? Then if we'd be following a recipe, it'd all be the same. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not why we're doing what we're doing. We're doing it because of diversity and adhering to making the best of what you got.
Excellent answer. That was very good. Thank you. You know, the industry has changed in a million ways. And even you guys, I mean, you're progressing in terms of your wine labels. But people have gone to bags, boxes, you know, cans, all kinds of things. What do you think about those different formats?
I think it's great. I mean, I just kind of like what we just talked about. I mean, there's a million ways to skin a cat, and I think that diversity is a good thing, and I think there's something for everyone and everything. So if you want to drink wine out of a can or a box, like, that's fine. And there's some pretty good wines that have kind of moved towards that packaging type and vessel, and hats off to them. And I've seen a lot of people have a lot of success with that. And this industry is about tradition, but it's also about assimilation and making sure that when change comes, as we've seen in the decades, that you adapt and assimilate to that. So the vines are going to throw you something different every year. The weather is going to be different every year. No two fermentations are ever the same. No two barrels ever taste the same. So you have to take all of that into account and figure out what's the best way to go about it. And, you know, if you want to throw it in a can, I'm not going to lie. They're really nice for picnics or taking to the beach, you know, like dragging a couple bottles of wine around. It's very romantic and it's beautiful and everything. But, like, if you just want to have a nice, you know, crisp rosé at the beach or in the park, hell, put it in a can. I think it's great.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, especially no judgment here, right?
Yeah, absolutely not.
Yeah, excellent. Michael, this has been a lot of fun to talk to you. For our listeners who would like to learn about Post and Beam Wine, I assume you have a website. What is that?
Yeah, so just go to the farniente.com, and that has a tab for all of our different labels, and Post and Beam being one of them. Also, you know, if you want to follow the Instagram page, I believe it's just at postandbeamwinery.com. So it's a way to kind of keep in touch and see what's going on with what we're doing.
Very cool. Well, I certainly look forward to drinking one of your wines soon enough. I really do appreciate you making time in your busy day. I wish you guys luck heading into this 2021 year, and thanks for being with us.
No, thank you, Ray. I really appreciate it.
Learn more by visiting postandbeam.com.
Listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Copyright 2021.